ותלאי סיים מפקד המים ותתיסה.
We've heard about Dhruva Maharaj and how he went back to Godhead and the prayers that were offered in glorification of him by Narada Muni in the assembly of Prachetas, the Prachetas. And thereafter, Madhura asked Maitreya Muni about the Prachetas and their assembly, and Maitreya Muni began to respond by telling about the descendants of Dhruva Maharaj. And first he described how Dhruva had one son whose name was Utkala, who did not desire to sit on the throne, to become the king when Dhruva went to the forest. And Maitreya Muni explains why. And the reason was that Utkala, everywhere he looked, he was so advanced that he saw the super soul. He didn't just see the individuals, he saw the super soul within everyone's heart. He was a great Mahabhagavat. He wasn't at all on the material platform, so he didn't want to deal with the opulences of being the king sitting on the throne. In text 9, and we'll read the purport that describes something about the nature of Utkala. So here is describing something about Utkala here, and this is text 9. By expansion of his knowledge of the Supreme Brahman, Utkala, he had already attained liberation from the bondage of the body. This liberation is known as Nirvana. He was situated in transcendental bliss, and he continued always in that blissful existence, which expanded more and more. This was possible for him by continual practice of bhakti yoga, which is compared to fire because it burns away all dirty material things. He is always situated in his constitutional position. He was always situated in his constitutional position of self-realization. Constitutional means that the foundational, the actual basic position of himself, he was situated in that. He envisioned himself, in other words, as a soul. That's the constitutional position, our natural, fundamental, foundational position. And he could not see anything else but the Supreme Lord and himself engaged in discharging devotional service. So his vision was like that. Everywhere he looked, stavaram jagamam deki na deki taramuti. He didn't just see the different living entities. What he saw, he didn't see moving and non-moving things exactly. What he saw was sarvatra hoyanija ishtadeva murti. He saw everything as a manifestation of the Lord. So here is Prabhupada's purport. These two verses explain the verse in the Bhagavad Gita 18:54. Ramabhuta prasanatma nasochati nakamchati samasaveshu bhuteshu madbhaktin labhate param. One who is transcendentally situated at once realizes the Supreme Brahman and becomes fully joyful. He never laments nor desires to have anything. He is equally disposed towards every living entity. So this is very wonderful. This is what it means to be transcendentally situated. The most basic level of transcendental realization. Above the material nature and joyful. Never lamenting, na sochati, na kanchati, never wanting anything, never desiring to have anything material. In this world, those who are trapped in this world, conditioned souls, just caught between lamenting and desiring. He is equally disposed towards every living entity. He sees the true equality of every living entity. He sees that they are souls and that Krishna is within their hearts. And in that state, in that pure state, above the realm of Maya, He achieves pure devotional service unto me, Krishna explains. This is also explained by Lord Chaitanya in Shikshastaka, in the beginning of the first verse. Cheto darpanam marjanam bhava mahadvagnina vapanam shreya karayava chandrika vataranam vidyavaru jivanam. The bhakti yoga system is the topmost yoga system. And in this system, the chanting of the holy name of the Lord is the foremost performance of devotional service. By chanting the holy name, one can attain the perfection of nirvana, or liberation from material existence, and so increase one's blissful life of spiritual existence, as described by Lord Chaitanya Nandam Buddhi Varadhanam. When one is situated in that position, he no longer has any interest in material opulence or even a royal throne and sovereignty over the whole planet. This situation is called Varaktir Anyatra Syat. It is the result of devotional service, complete detachment to everything material. The more one makes advancement in devotional service, the more one becomes detached from material opulence and material activity. This is the spiritual nature, full of bliss. So due to the bliss of spiritual attachment, spiritual realization, one becomes detached from the lesser happinesses of the material world. This is also described in the Bhagavad Gita, 259, second chapter, 59 verse. Param dvistvanavartite. He experiences a higher taste. One ceases to take part in material enjoyment upon tasting superior blissful life and spiritual existence. By advancement in spiritual knowledge, which is considered to be like blazing fire, all material desires are burnt to ashes. The perfection of mystic yoga is possible when one is continuously in connection with the Supreme Personality of Godhead by discharging devotional service. So this is the process of getting connected or breaking the connection with matter by being continuously in connection with the Lord through devotional service. A devotee is always thinking of the Supreme Personality, the Supreme Person, at every step of his life. Every conditioned soul is full of the reactions of his past life. But all dirty things, all those reactions, are immediately burnt to ashes if one simply executes devotional service. This is described in the Narada Pancharatra, Sarvapadi Venimuktam Tatparadvena Nirmalam. So all artificial coverings over our true self, Vinayamuktam, free from those, and in the pure consciousness, Tat Paradvena Nirmalam, be situated in the pure, clean consciousness of Krishna consciousness. So that's what Utkal was like. Internally, that's what he was like. He was fully experiencing Krishna everywhere. And externally, what was he like? Text 10 describes that. Utkal appeared to the less intelligent persons on the road to be foolish, blind, dumb, deaf, and mad, although actually he was not so. He remained like fire covered with ashes, without blazing flames. In other words, he didn't manifest his spiritual realization. He appeared just internally inert and externally not interested or dull. Prabhupada's purport. In order to avoid contradiction, botheration, and unfavorable situations created by materialistic persons, a great saintly person like Jadabharat or Utkal remains silent. They just wander around as if they were mad, but internally thinking only about Krishna. They just don't want to get involved in the material world, because when someone is mad, people may tease them, people may throw things at them, but they leave them alone. And that's just what these people wanted. They wanted to be unentangled in the world of matter, so they act in this way. Factually, an advanced devotee avoids speaking with persons who are not in devotional life. But to those who are in devotional life, he speaks in friendship, and he speaks to the innocent for their enlightenment. For all practical purposes, the whole world is full of non-devotees. And so, one kind of very advanced devotee is called Bhajananandi. Bhajananandi means one who is fully experiencing bliss through his own personal worship. And he doesn't care about any preaching. So this Utkal was Bhajananandi. But those who are Gostiyanandi, however, that means they go around and preach, however, preach to increase the number of devotees. But even such preachers also avoid opposing elements who are unfavorably disposed to its spiritual life. Text 11. For this reason, the ministers and all the elderly members of the family thought Utkal to be without intelligence and in fact mad. Thus his younger brother named Vatsa, the son of Brahmi, was elevated to the royal throne and he became king of the world. So the ministers, it wasn't a, even though there was a monarchy, it wasn't completely autocratic in the sense that the king just did whatever he wanted. No, there were ministers in the royal family and there was a process of decision making. So the ministers and the family there, the senior members of the family, they understood that Utkal was not at all suitable. They thought he was mad. But in any case, he was unsuitable to rule, practically speaking. So they gave preference to Vatsar, his younger brother. King Vatsar had a very dear wife whose name was Svarviti. And she gave birth to six sons named Pushparna, Tigmaketu, Isha, Urja, Vasu, and Jaya. A little interesting short purport here. Vatsara's wife is mentioned here as Ishta, which means worshipable. In other words, it appears that Vatsara's wife had all good qualifications. For example, she was always very faithful and obedient and affectionate to her husband. She had all good qualities for managing household affairs. If both the husband and wife are endowed with good qualities and live peacefully, then nice children take birth, and thus the whole family is happy and prosperous. So one of the six sons, Pushparna, he had two wives named Prabha and Dosh. Prabha had three sons named Pratta, Madhyadinam, and Sayam. Dosh had three sons, Pradosh, Nishishta, and Vyusta. Vyusta's wife was named Pushkarini, and she gave birth to a powerful son named Sarvateja. Sarvateja literally means all power. So there were so many sons in the generations that follow. Then finally, of the 12 sons of Ulmuka, of the 12 sons, of the son of the son of the son, like that, Ulmuka was one of the 12, begot six sons and his wife Pushkarini. They were all very good sons, and their names were Anga, Sumana, Kyati, Kratu, Angira, and Gaya. The wife of Anga, Suniti, gave birth to a son named Vena, who was very crooked. So just after saying that the good parents give birth to good sons, here is an example of Anga, who was so good and pure in the dynasty of Dhruva Maharaj. His wife was Sunita, and they gave birth to Vena, who was very, very bad. The saintly King Anga was very disappointed with Vena's bad character, and he left home and kingdom and went out to the forest. My dear Vidur, when great sages curse, their words are as invincible as thunderbolts. Thus, when they cursed King Vena, who was so crooked, they cursed him out of anger. He died. After his death, since there was no king, all the rogues and thieves flourished. The kingdom became unregulated and all the citizens suffered greatly. On seeing this, the great sages took the right hand of Vena as a churning rod, and as a result of their churning, Lord Vishnu in his partial representation made his advent as King Prithu. So Anga's son was Vena, Vena's son was Prithu, churned from the dead body. And King Prithu is called Adiraj, the original emperor of the world. Vidura inquired, so Vidura was hearing this history from Maitreya, and he said, "My dear Brahmana, dear Maitreya, King Anga was very gentle. He had high character and was a saintly personality and a lover of Brahminical culture. How is it that such a great soul had a bad son like Vena, because of whom he became indifferent to his kingdom and left it?" Vidura also inquired, "How is it that the great sages who were completely conversant with religious principles desired to curse King Vena, who himself carried the rod of punishment and thus awarded him the greatest punishment, Brahma Sapa? They killed him with a Brahminical curse. So how is it?" So he's asking, they asked, how did Vena have, how did Anga have a bad son? And how was it that the king who is called Naradev, who is supposed, he's representing Krishna on earth, carrying the power to chastise and maintain law and order. He represents Krishna in that way. So why was it that he, what did he do that was so awful and terrible that caused the great sages who don't usually take part in any politics at all, why did they kill him? What did he do that made them kill him? To remove him from his position. That was the ultimate thing they could do, by cursing, kill him. Why did they do this? What inspired him then? Text 23. "It is the duty of all citizens in a state never to insult the king, even though he sometimes appears to have done something very sinful. Because of his prowess, the king is always more influential than all other ruling chiefs." So everyone has to respect the king, the ruler, even if the king does something somewhat improper. Because if the authority isn't respected, then the society goes down so quickly. With everyone just, because the king's duty is to maintain law and order, and if he is disrespected, that means the government, the law and order, is going to be disrespected. And if the law and order is disrespected, then people do whatever they want. And if people do whatever they want, not caring for law and order, then what happens? Then society becomes insane and mad. I feel like doing it, therefore I'll do it. Killing, looting, stealing, anything. So the sages are asking, why did this happen? So Vidura requested Maitreya, "My dear Brahmana, you are well conversant with all subjects, both past and future. Therefore I wish to hear from you about all the activities of King Vena. I'm your faithful devotee, so please explain this." So he was sincere and surrendered, so he asked him, he had the right to ask, "Please tell me everything about King Vena." So Maitreya began to tell the story of cruel King Vena. He said, "My dear Vidura, once the great King Anga," that was the son, one of the descendants of Dhruva Maharaj and the father of Vena, "once King Anga arranged to perform the great sacrifice known as Aswamedha. All the expert brahmanas present knew how to invite the demigods. So the purpose of this Aswamedha, or the horse sacrifice, was to please the, ultimately it's to please Vishnu, the Lord, but also to please the demigods. So they knew how to invoke or evoke the presence of the demigods through the proper chanting of mantras. So the brahmanas knew this. So, but in spite of their attempting to evoke the demigods and the sacrifices, no demigods participated or appeared in the sacrifice." So Prabhupada in his purport explained that in Kali Yuga, the different sacrifices that evoke demigods for the purpose of pleasing Vishnu, etc., and especially Aswamedha sacrifice, In Kali Yuga, no one can do these properly. In this age in which we live, no one can perform them properly. So therefore, as Prabhupada explains in the last sentence, there is only one sacrifice, one type of sacrifice to please the Lord that is done in Kali Yuga, and that is called Sankirtan. And Prabhupada says in the last line, in this age, therefore, the only practical jagya is Sankirtan jagya, or chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra 24 hours a day. The priests, after the sacrifice wasn't successful in invoking the demigods, everyone was wondering, why? What's gone wrong? What did we do wrong? What mistake was made? Is there some sin or impropriety present? So the priests who were engaged in the sacrifice then informed King Anga, O king, we are properly offering the ghee, the clarified butter in the sacrifice. But despite all our efforts, the demigods do not accept it. O king, we know that the paraphernalia to perform the sacrifice is well collected by you with great faith and care. It is not polluted because everything has to be exactly correct. When performing a Vedic sacrifice, everything, the pronunciation of the words, the ingredients, the ritual, how to do it, the setting up of this, everything has to be exactly correct. No mistakes are allowed if the actual result is to be obtained. So they're saying that the result isn't coming, but yet the paraphernalia is proper. You've collected it with great faith and care. It is not contaminated. Our chanting of the Vedic hymns is also not deficient in any way. And there used to be a checker priest. So some priests would be chanting the mantras and performing the rituals, and another priest, his job was to just watch and make sure everything was done exactly correctly. And if there was something done incorrectly, he had to correct it. He had to check and correct it, and it had to be redone. Otherwise, if things were pronounced improperly, then the exact opposite could happen. So they're saying that the chanting of the hymns, the paraphernalia is all pure, the chanting of the hymns is not deficient in any way, for all the Brahmins and priests present here are expert and are all executing the performances properly. And Prabhupada, in the last line of this purport, explains, as just explained, that the Sankirtan Jagya is the only Jagya that can practically be performed, or the only sacrifice that can practically be performed in Kali Yuga. And here, in the last line, he says, even if the Hare Krishna mantra is not chanted properly, it still has so much potency that the chanter gains the effect. So different from the Vedic sacrifices. So the Brahmin has continued, my dear king, we do not find any reason that the demigods should feel insulted or neglected in any way. But still the demigods, who are witnesses for the sacrifices, do not accept their share. They don't accept what we're offering to them. We do not know why this is so. We'll read Prabhupada's purport in this regard. It is indicated herein that if there is negligence on the part of the priest, the demigods do not accept their share in sacrifices. Similarly, in devotional service, there are offenses known as sevaparad. It means offenses while performing seva or service. Those who are engaged in worshipping the deity, Radha and Krishna, in the temple, should avoid such offenses in service. The offenses in service are described in the Nectar of Devotion. If we simply make a show of offering services to the deity but do not care for the sevaparad, certainly the Radha Krishna deity will not accept offerings from such non-devotees. Devotees engaged in temple worship should not therefore manufacture their own methods, but should strictly follow the regulative principles of cleanliness, and then offerings will be accepted. So the Brahmins are saying, for some reason or another, everything seems to be right, but yet the sacrifice isn't successful, and the demigods aren't coming to accept the offerings. So after hearing the statement of the priest, Maharaj Anga, who was sponsoring, participating, was being done, and the sacrifice was being done on his behalf, he was greatly aggrieved. At that time, he took permission from the priest to break his silence, because no one during the sacrifice could speak. And he inquired from all the priests who were present in the sacrificial arena. He addressed the priests and said, "My dear priests, kindly tell me what offense I have committed. Although invited, the demigods are neither taking part in the sacrifice nor accepting their shares. So what have I done wrong?" The head priest replied, "O king, in this life we do not find any sinful activity. But even within your mind you never did anything wrong." So how pure these people were. Not only didn't they do anything wrong in their life, they never even thought of anything sinful or inappropriate. So how pious and pure the people in this age were. So he said, "Even within your mind you have never done anything wrong, so you are not in the least offensive. But we can see that in your previous life you performed sinful activities, due to which, in spite of your having all qualifications, you have no son." "O king, we wish all good fortune for you. You have no son. But if you pray at once to the Supreme Lord and ask for a son, and if you execute the sacrifice for that purpose, the enjoyer of the sacrifice, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, will fulfill your desire. So don't do the Aswamedha sacrifice. Because you have in your previous life committed sins, that is the cause of your not having a son. So therefore, please the Lord by another sacrifice and have a son, and therefore you'll be successful." When Hari, the supreme enjoyer of all sacrifices, is invited to fulfill your desire for a son, all the demigods will come with him and take their share of the sacrifices. So this is the plan. First get the Lord to come, and then the demigods will automatically come. And now, with the Aswamedha Yagya, we're trying to get the demigods to come without having the Lord come. And it's not working due to some fault. So you perform the sacrifice of having a son, then the Lord will come, and then the demigods will also come, so we'll have our purpose served. The performer of the sacrifices under Karmakan activities, the Vedic activities, for fruitive activities, achieves the fulfillment of the desire for which he worships the Lord. Thus, for the sake of a son, for King Anga, they decided to offer oblations to Lord Vishnu, who is situated in the hearts of all living entities. As soon as the oblation was offered in the fire, as soon as the offering of the ghee was made in the fire, a person appeared from the fire altar, wearing a golden garland and a white dress. He was carrying a golden pot filled with rice boiled in milk. The king was very liberal, and after taking permission from the priests, he took the preparation in his joined palms, and after smelling it, he offered a portion to his wife. Here's Prabhupada's purport. The word udhara di is significant in this connection. This means very liberal-minded, very generous. The wife of the king, Sunita, was not fit to accept this benediction of this rice that was given by the Lord when he came in the sacrificial performance. Yet, even though his wife was not fit to accept the benediction, the king was so liberal that without hesitation he offered to his wife the boiled rice in milk prasad received from the Jagya Purusha, the Lord of the sacrifice. Of course, everything is designed by the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As will be explained in later verses, this incident was not favorable for the king. Since the king was very liberal, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in order to increase his detachment from this material world, willed that a cruel son be born of the king, so that the king would have to leave home. As stated above, Lord Vishnu fulfills the desires of the Karmis as they desire. But the Lord fulfills the desires of a devotee in a different way, so that the devotee may gradually come to Him. So very, very important. So the actual result of the kings giving this sweet rice preparation that came from the sacrifice, the result on one level was awful. He gave it to an unqualified queen who had a bad son, and as a result of that, practically speaking, the father felt tortured, and therefore he left the whole kingdom out of frustration and went to the forest. So on one level, how horrible. Because the king is no wimp. He's such a powerful person, sinless, powerful, strong chastiser of the rogues and thieves. But yet he was so frustrated, so driven crazy, practically speaking, by his son, that he just gave up everything. So how much difficulty his son must have given him. But yet, on the other side, this was Krishna's mercy, because out of that difficulty, out of that disappointment, came what? Detachment. So this same point will be explained two times in the 11th canto, in the story of Pingala, the prostitute. She was very upset that her desires weren't fulfilled. And then as a result of being upset, she became detached. And as a result of becoming detached, she became happy by taking shelter of the Lord. So in the material world, or for a materialist, good and bad actually doesn't exist. Because everything ultimately turns bad for a materialist. Even if it superficially appears good, ultimately it turns bad. It increases its entanglement in some way or another, which ultimately means misery. But for a devotee, similarly but contrarily, there is also no good and bad. Everything is good, even if it superficially appears bad. Because even the bad, by Krishna's arrangement, is being sent by Krishna to decrease our attachment from the world of matter and increase our attachment to Him. So Krishna treats the devotees differently than He treats the non-devotees. This is what's being described. So as will be explained in later verses, this incident was not very favorable for the king. Since the king was very liberal, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, in order to increase his detachment from this material world, willed that a cruel son be born of the queen, so that the king would have to leave home. As stated above, Lord Vishnu fulfills the desires of the karmis as they desire. But the Lord fulfills the desire of a devotee in a different way, so that the devotee may gradually come to Him. This is confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, Dadami Buddhi Yogam Tam Yena Mamu Vyantite. The Lord gives the devotee the opportunity to make progress further and further, so that he may come back home, back to Godhead. Although the queen had no son, this is text 38, after eating that food which had the power to produce a male child, she became pregnant by her husband, and in due course of time she gave birth to a son. The boy was born partially in the dynasty of irreligion. His grandfather was death personified, and the boy grew up as his follower, his grandfather's follower. He became a greatly irreligious person. We'll read the second paragraph of Prabhupada's purport. It appears that King Anga did not get a very good wife in Sunita, because she was the daughter of death personified. Sometimes the Lord arranges an unfortunate wife for His devotees, so that gradually, due to family circumstances, the devotee becomes detached from his wife and home and makes progress in devotional life. It appears that by the arrangement of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, King Anga, although a pious devotee, got an unfortunate wife like Sunita, and later on a bad child like Veena. But the result was that he got complete freedom from the entanglement of family life and left home to go back to Godhead. So what was this boy, the grandson of death personified, what was he like when he was young? This is some verses that describe his nature. After fixing his bow and arrow, the cruel boy used to go to the forest and unnecessarily kill innocent deer. And as soon as he came, all the people would cry, "Here comes cruel Vena! Here comes cruel Vena!" So he was, everyone was very frightened of him. The boy was so cruel that while playing with young boys of his age, he would kill them very mercilessly, as if they were animals meant for slaughter. After seeing the cruel and merciless behavior of his son, Vena, King Anga punished him in different ways to reform him, but he was unable to bring him to the path of gentleness. He thus became greatly aggrieved. The king thought to himself, "Persons who have no sons are certainly fortunate." Just see, this is the nature of desires. One has no children, and then one's thinking, "Oh, I'm so unfortunate, I'm so sad." And therefore, he gets married or something, and then has his family. And then when he's married and has his family, he's thinking, "Oh, people have no family, they're so fortunate, and I'm so unfortunate." Because our desires become our curse. The fulfillment of our desires become our curse. But really, truly, the only thing that will fill the emptiness, the misery that is in every conditioned soul's heart, is having a relationship with Krishna. So everyone imagines that, "Oh, if I only have this, if I only have that, if I only have this, a new one of these, if I get this and that." But nothing actually can satisfy us. Everything is just a different form of anxiety other than our relationship with Krishna. So the king thought, "Persons who have no sons are certainly fortunate." He was thinking before, "Persons who have sons are fortunate, and I am unfortunate because I have no sons." They must have worshipped the Lord in their previous lives, that they would not have to suffer the unbearable happiness caused by a bad son. A sinful son causes a person's reputation to vanish. His irreligious activities at home cause irreligion and quarrel amongst everyone, and this creates only endless anxiety. Who, if he is considerate and intelligent, would desire such a worthless son? Such a son is nothing but a bond of illusion for the living entity, and he makes one's home miserable. Then the king thought, "A bad son," he turned it around, "a bad son is better than a good son." What? First he's saying how unfortunate it is to have a bad son, or any son, because it's a bad son. Now he's saying, but on the other hand, a bad son is better than a good son. Why? Because a good son creates attachment for home, which causes us trouble at the time of death. Whereas a bad son does not. A bad son creates a hellish home, for which an intelligent man naturally becomes very easily detached. Prabhupada's purport towards the end. King Anga, therefore, thinking in terms of detachment, accepted his bad son as a good impetus for detachment from home life. He therefore considered his bad son his friend, since he was helping him become detached from his home. His bad son taught him detachment. Guru, Krishna acted in this way. Ultimately, one has to learn how to detach oneself from attachment to material life. Therefore, if a bad son, by his behavior, helps a householder to go away from home, it is a boon. Thinking like that, King Anga could not sleep at night. He became completely indifferent to household life. Once, therefore, in the dead of night, he got up from bed and left. Vena's mother, his wife, who was sleeping deeply. He gave up all attraction for his greatly opulent kingdom, and unseen by anyone, he very silently gave up his home and opulence and proceeded towards the forest. It was very difficult to do, to give up one's attachment to opulence and living in a comfortable situation. Very, very difficult to give this up. But the king did it, so Vena was the greatest blessing for him in that sense. When it was understood that the king had indifferently left home, all the citizens, priests, ministers, friends, and people in general were greatly aggrieved. They began to search for him all over the world, just as a less experienced mystic searches out the supersoul within himself. So a less experienced mystic, he searches out for the supersoul, but just as the citizens could not find the king even though they searched for him, the less experienced mystic cannot find the Lord of the heart. What does he find? Maybe at best he finds Brahman. When the citizens could not find any trace of the king after searching for him everywhere, they were very disappointed. And they returned to the city where all the great sages of the country assembled because of the king's absence. With tears in their eyes, the citizens offered respectful obeisances and informed the sages in full detail that they were unable to find the king anywhere. Thus in the Bhaktivedanta Purports of the 4th canto, 13th chapter of Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled Description of the Descendants of Dhruva Maharaj. Now the next chapter, 14, is all about King Vena. And what happens to King Vena? So we'll stop here. We'll begin that if Krishna arrives next Wednesday. Any questions? Thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Yep.
As a king, he was placed also to give service to his people. Wouldn't he have had also an obligation?
Yes.
To serve the children of Krishna.
Yes.
And he also ran away.
Yes, from his duty. So this is also explained in other places too. So on one level, we could fault him in that. But we will say two things in this regard. One is that this is ultimately arranged by Krishna, as was intimated, because Krishna wanted not that Vena become king. He wanted Vena's son, as we'll hear about, Prithu Maharaj, who was the most exalted of kings. He was empowered by Krishna. So on one level, this is pastimes. These are just plays by the Lord for his own purpose. On the other level, although it is the duty of the king to make sure that there is a proper person to fill his position, and we'll hear about that later, and we heard Dhruva Maharaj did it when there was a proper person, and Uttanapad did, his father did it when Dhruva Maharaj was considered ready. So that's generally speaking the duty, that no king would leave without installing his son, a proper qualified son. But yet another example is given here that is contrary to that. And that is that our foremost duty is to our spiritual life. And the tendency, using the excuse of duties, is to stay in family life and enjoying it in comfortableness to the very end. So out of the three different points, or three different, say, points that are made from a king with a son, one is that it's Krishna's pastime, and therefore Krishna inspired him to leave. And second is, yes, this is generally the case, that it's the duty. But then, the third point is also very important, that the example of leaving home and going to the forest at the end of one's life is really essential. The renunciation of material life at the end of one's life to prepare for death. This is the Vedic culture, and it's something that's it's foreign in the West, very, very foreign. Because what do people in the West do nowadays? They just, when they're old, previously they would stay at home taken care of by the family, but now the family very conveniently puts them in nursing homes so no one has to see them or take care of them. And what do they do in nursing homes? They make believe they're kids again and have parties and watch television and play games, make believe that they're irresponsible kids, and not really take those twilight years to prepare for the inevitable. Instead, people forget, they use those years to forget what's going to happen, as if forgetting about it is going to stop it from happening. So those three are there, but you're definitely right that that was the general system.
Thank you.
Right. Yes?
You mentioned this personified. Is he different with the
I also, I don't think it did mention that, but I was also wondering about that. Let's see what words are there. I would think not, because the son of of Yamaraj would be someone of the quality of Yudhisthira. He's a servant of Krishna. What word is used? Mrityum, not Yama. Adomika, irreligion itself. So in one sense, what's the cause of death? It's irreligion. So it must be from a different point of view, from a different perspective. Thank you. Any other questions or comments? Okay. Early night. Hare Krishna. Did you work hard today?
It was a pretty big day.
What did you do?
We could seven.
Wow. And when are they going to be served to all the 400 people?
Some tomorrow.
Where? What's going on tomorrow?
First of all,
Huh? What? Okay.
I don't know.
There's a Mandra festival the next week, right?
Something.
Okay. But anyway, fortunate Bentleys.
I think it's an old folks.
Well, there you go.
No, it's a children's festival.
Huh?
It's a multicultural festival.
It's a multicultural filled with old people and young people and children. And is there anything on Sunday, this Sunday?
There's a thing we're having a Sunday feast for the first time, and we changed program. Which should be interesting, I guess.
And the next Sunday, there's something in Mandra, right? Okay. And that next Sunday is about the 5th or the 6th or something. 7th, right? 7th. Yeah. And then 2 weeks after that, around that, is the Conscious Living Festival. And is there one the following week?
Ostak.
Huh? Ostak. Ostak? That's very original, isn't it? Excuse me?
I'm asking heavy metal concert.
Oh. Will you go?
No. It's gonna be so loud.
Yeah, you have to wear earplugs. I'm stuck. Okay, Hare Krishna, thank you very much. So we'll hear more about King Vena next week. Will you come and hear about King Vena next week in Preetu Maharaj?
Certainly, I enjoy these classes very much.
Oh, that's good. What do you do when you're not sitting here?
I'm the Human Rights Convener for the United Nations Association.
Oh.
And I deal with other people's problems.
Yeah.
Try to advise them the best I can.
What do you tell them?
Well, it depends on... there's a mixture. If I can facilitate, then I do so. If they have the personal problems are clear out of their own emotional state, and I try to give them advice.
Not easy.
It's not easy. To give advice is easy.
Yes.
But for the individual to take up the advice and to follow it is harder.
You're fighting.
Even harder it is to follow your own advice.
Yeah.
Interesting, however, in this the scripture which we're reading today is the parallel in human behavior to create your own hell, where the Christian scripture talks about hell, which I personally believe is the what you make on earth. I do not believe there's hell or heaven as such. It is through your own particular lifestyle that either you make it up in your development and in your evolution closer to the Godhead, or you're going backwards and getting more and more punished until you get your lessons. But of course, being more and more punished, you're going through a state of great unease or disease, mental or physical sickness.
Yeah, and how to turn it around. That's the big issue of life.
Well, it's realization. I think it comes when you've been hit on the head. As many times as I have.
Although, yeah, there's it's described in, I think, in Ishopanishad, I think. It describes how there's different ways people learn. The intelligent person learns by hearing. Person who is second class intelligence as opposed to first learns by being hit on the head.
Must be.
Well, but the third person in class doesn't even learn by being hit on the head. That must be me. So I'm just second class at least. I'm first class.
Yeah.